7:07, and here with what it says in the papers is Clodagh Walsh.
Two stories dominate the front pages this morning. The death of 27-year-old Yolanta Lubienia and her 8-year-old daughter Enrique, and the visit here of America's First Lady Michelle Obama and her daughters. There is also the matter of the G8 summit, but just not on the front pages. The Irish Daily Mail, the Irish Examiner and the Herald all lead with a discovery in Kilorgan, County Kerry, of the bodies of the young mother and daughter. It's reported, as you heard in our own bulletin, that a murder inquiry is expected to be launched following the results of the post-mortem later today. While the Irish Times lead concentrates on the business at hand at the G8 summit, elsewhere it's Michelle Obama who steals the limelight. On the front of the Irish Sun, over a photo of President and Mrs. Obama, the headline, "We're only barrack for the crack." "So good to be home," the headline in the Irish Independent, above a photo of Mrs. Obama and her two daughters, with Lee's hand writing that for this island nation it was a day of firsts, from the First Lady to another oratorical wonder from her husband, the US President. Both their contributions for the G8 visit sent the message that Ireland had turned a corner. Inside there's page after page of photos, as there is in all the papers. Plenty on what the Obama family were up to yesterday, and lots of coverage of Michelle Obama's speech in both the Waterfront Hall in Belfast and the Gaiety Theatre in Dublin, where, as the Times puts it, she stressed the importance of community, tradition and personal resilience. Elsewhere in that paper, Arthur Beasley reminds us that while the serious business of the summit started yesterday, as the leaders discussed the global economy, this morning tax will dominate. With new efforts to clamp down on aggressive avoidance by big business high on the agenda, this, he says, is something which could yet cause problems for Ireland. And the business of the summit is well and truly dissected and analysed in the papers this morning. Many also reporting on the British Prime Minister's silence following claims from the US National Security Agency worker Edward Snowden that Britain spied on delegates at the G20 summit in 2009. Fergus Finlay, writing in the Examiner, says Mr. Snowden deserves our thanks for revealing the world of surveillance, and says that if he's listened to, he may save us all from a future where power is increasingly concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer people. And to other matters now, that paper also reports on a new high-tech facility at the Midwestern Regional Hospital in Limerick, which will allow keyhole surgery on colon cancer patients. The Stryker iSuite Theatre is the first voice-activated, integrated operating theatre of its type in this country and enables surgeons confer with colleagues across the world by video link. The Mail reports that an ERSI conference will hear today that patients are being forced to shoulder the burden of health cuts by paying more for services. The conference, organised by the ERSI and Trinity College, will look at how health systems respond to economic crisis. Elsewhere in that paper, as in many of the papers today, there's several articles following the publication of photos of celebrity chef Nigella Lawson being held around the throat by her husband Charles Saatchi. Mr. Saatchi said it was just a playful tiff. The articles question whether it was just that or heavy-handed, and also look at domestic violence. And The Independent reports that the government will be asked to bring in a swappage scheme for owners of middle-aged cars. It would mean motorists getting a vehicle registration tax rebate when they trade in against a new model. And finally, to Miriam Lord, writing in The Times about Michelle Obama and her daughters, she says that just in case anybody doesn't realise how important these international superstars are, a meeting with Bono will leave nobody in doubt. They're having lunch in Dalkey today.
You'd have to. Clodagh, thank you very much. 7:10. Conor Brophy is here with the business.
Rachel, Ireland could be one of the biggest beneficiaries of any trade deal between the EU and US. Analysis by the IFO Institute at the University of Munich suggests that if a comprehensive agreement were reached to liberalise transatlantic trade, real income per head here would rise by almost 7%. Only the UK, where real incomes would rise by almost 10%, according to IFO, would be a bigger winner. It says between 4,500 and 18,000 jobs could be created here, depending on the extent of any such deal. Ireland, it reasons, would be among the biggest gainers because, like the UK, it already has deep links with the US and therefore is best placed to capitalise on the reduction in barriers such as tariffs on trade. It calculates that the cost of tariffs currently imposed on trade between America and the EU amounts to about 3.5% of the value of that trade. Having surveyed 2,000 high net worth individuals, that's people with net assets valued at more than $1.5 million, Barclays found 55% of the wealth attributed to Ireland's rich came from property. After all that's happened here, more than half the wealth of the wealthy here, a higher proportion than in any other country covered by the report, derives from bricks and mortar. On a global level, Barclays notes that a higher proportion of wealth is now being created through entrepreneurship than through inheritance. The chair of the UK's Public Accounts Committee, Margaret Hodge, is calling for tax advantages enjoyed by private equity firms on the money they borrow to take over companies to be reined in. That follows an investigation by the Financial Times, which found the companies, including the pharmaceutical chain Alliance Boots, have been able to pay less tax than their competitors by deducting interest payments on their debt from profit. Alliance Boots has accumulated £132 million tax credits since 2007 in this manner. Margaret Hodge said taxpayers should not be subsidising returns for private equity firms such as Boots owner New York-based KKR. Expect issues such as that, as Clodagh was saying there, to be very much on the agenda at the GA talks in Lockern this morning. The euro today trading at $1.335 and 85 pence sterling.
Welcome back. This is Morning Ireland at 14 minutes past 7. The talking is well underway at the Lockern Summit in County Fermanagh. The photo opportunities are not entirely, but pretty well over. And the analysis of body language has already started. Apart from that, what do we know about what's going on? Let's go to someone who's a lot closer to it than we are, Sean O'Rourke and Enniskillen. Good morning.
A lot closer, perhaps, Cathal, good morning to you, but perhaps not any better informed than anybody who's on the other side of the world. But I think, speaking of photo ops, that old truism that a picture is worth a thousand words was never more evident than last night at that photo opportunity when Vladimir Putin and Barack Obama got together. They talked for 2 hours, but I'm not sure that when a Harvard man met a KGB man, there was any great meeting of minds, though President Putin did manage to say afterwards that they had agreed to push the Syrian parties towards the negotiating table. And I think the British side are talking up hopes of an agreement on a communique, particularly where Syria is concerned, certainly that they may emphasise their desire to see peace talks going on in Geneva, though, again, Obama was quite pessimistic about that actually happening in an earlier interview before he left the States. But there may be agreement on things like trying to secure chemical weapons, pursuing extremists, and then ultimately creating an executive authority after undergoing a political transition in Syria. Again, signs, I think, as well here that whatever about differences, the gulf between Russia and the United States, that there are cracks as between, say, Obama and the British and the French on the question of how far Obama should go in, for instance, supporting to the extent of arming the Syrian rebels. Now, the other big topic, of course, taxation, transparency, economic development. Quite a big statement yesterday by David Cameron in terms of the value that the trade talks at the prize, if they get this trade agreement over the next 18 months in talks between Europe and the United States, that it could be worth £100 billion sterling to the EU, £80 billion sterling to the United States, and £85 billion to the rest of the world, the biggest bilateral trade deal in history. Also, a lot of attention on the whole question of tax. Again, the point has been made that everybody wants to crack down on tax avoidance and tax havens, but no country wants to give up its own tax advantages. So there are big decisions to be made on making multinationals pay more. But they again, as we heard yesterday from Sean Whelan, are more for the G20, which of course now is led or chaired at least by the Russians. So meanwhile, back here in Enniskillen, there was quite an atmosphere in the town last night. I mean, this whole exercise, this G8 event here at Lough Erne has brought enormous goodwill and publicity. Good for the town, as the saying goes, good for the county. Now, last night, a crowd estimated by police at around 800 people, they marched through Enniskillen out to the cordon surrounding the G8 summit, and quite a cordon it is too, aided and abetted by a lot of water, it has to be said. Now, they were met by a big police force, some of the 3,500 here policing the event. It did, as expected, pass off peacefully, it was the culmination of a day that was fairly relaxed, as our reporter Richard Darling found out when he went out to talk to people here about the summit.
The very recently formed G8 Voice of the People Choir attracted a crowd into St Michael's Parish Church yesterday afternoon. Singers from Ireland, Scotland and England were participating, as Claire Negrina explained.
The idea of it is, do you know, there's all this hype about blooming protesters and all that, and we're saying, do you know what, we're just going to go right into the middle of it, and this is who we are, and we want to just sing, inspire, uplift people, and hopefully that those G9 people who are gathered out in Lough Erne, all those big decisions they're making on our behalf, culturally, politically, environmentally, socially, they affect us all.
Outside in the streets of the town, there was a large police presence, but the atmosphere was calm and relaxed.
Just up for the afternoon for shopping, and just came along to see what was going on here. But that's very interesting. It's a great kind of a carnival atmosphere here, and everybody's enjoying themselves.
Was it a good day for shopping?
Not really.
I'm here just to raise awareness about socialism and basically what the fat cats and the G8 are doing to us. That's the reason I'm here.
There's not that many protesters here yet. Are you surprised?
I was surprised. We were here very early because we thought it would kick off early, but apparently there's a protest starting now upside the library at 3 o'clock, but apparently the whole thing isn't starting until about 6 o'clock. So we've been here all day just having the crack and enjoying this town. It's a lovely town, and enjoying the people, and everyone's here in good form. It's a good day.
Yeah, come on. There you go.
Along the route, the protesters would march. The PSNI had deployed a large number of officers and vehicles. One of the units was in a housing estate where 7-year-old Ara Tate explored the vehicles with the help of the English police officers.
Well, fun. And I have been taking photographs.
Across the road, sitting on the grass on a summer's evening, Robert Fitzpatrick and Vanialu Casey were waiting, along with many others, for the protest march to pass.
Well, something like this never happens around here, so it's great excitement, and we just thought we'd come down to see it. It's a lovely evening. And
it's peaceful as well, so at least we don't feel that we're putting the children in danger by bringing them down, and they can take in the atmosphere as well and see what's going to happen.
And the protest did come along and march towards the large metal gates surrounding the summit location.
Anti-G8. No fracking.
What do you hope the march will achieve?
That all the present and they'll understand and hear us out.
Just ask you why you're here.
It's the right thing to do.
Do you think it'll achieve anything?
Probably not. Well, it'd be nice to do, but you know me. You'd look at people as honest in the world. They're not honest down there.
Another world is possible. Another world is within our grasp. Down with the G8. Up with people.
On arrival, the protesters were addressed by several speakers. Eventually, just after 9 o'clock, a small number, maybe about 40, trampled across the wire fence into a field, followed by the same number of media. As they chanted, police with riot shields emerged into the next field.
Stay behind the hedgerows!
But eventually departing buses for the demonstrators brought it all to an abrupt and very peaceful end.
Any protesters from Belfast, Dublin, Omagh or Derry on the G8 not welcome buses? The return parade is now leaving. You need to come back, join the return parade at the Enniskillen to get your guaranteed seat on the bus.
Richard Dowling reporting there from last night's protest. We'll have more later from the GA and Enniskillen, but right now it's back to Dublin and Cahill.
We're going to look now at the specifics that the leaders are talking about today. There is obviously a general political shift or trend underway towards having multinationals be more accountable, be more transparent, and also paying more tax to states. Quite how that'll happen and quite when it'll happen, obviously this is only one stage in that process. We're going to look specifically at what is on the table at the moment for this G8 summit, and joining us to analyse is John Gulliver, who's a tax partner with Mason Hayes and Curran Accountants, which advises multinational companies. John, welcome to the programme. Just tell us, perhaps some of us can guess, but what exactly do you advise multinationals based in Ireland about what they can do?
Morning. I work at Mason Hayes, lawyers rather than accountants, just to clarify that. But I primarily advise US corporates coming to Ireland on how to arrange their affairs.
In terms of keeping their tax as low as possible?
Not necessarily keeping it as low as possible, but what I try to ensure is that Ireland Ireland is their stopping off point when they come to Europe rather than to elsewhere, and thereby create more opportunities for Ireland Inc. And I think the current debate, the key in the current debate about tax, tax competition, base erosion and the rest, is about ensuring that in the EU-US trade deal, Ireland gets its fair share of new business. And right, that's absolutely key. We don't erode that position.
Right, well, let's get your assessment as head of tax at Mason Hayes and Curran. Of the proposals which the OECD have put to this summit, I'll just go through them very specifically. They are, one, enacting framework legislation so the countries could expand the number of partnerships they have, in other words, tax relationships with other countries. Two, selecting the legal basis for the exchange of information. Three, adapting the scope of reporting and due diligence requirements and coordinating guidance. And four, developing common or compatible IT standards. It's good as far as it goes. It's fairly basic stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting. This is an overnight press release from the OECD. Really what it's aimed at, it seems, is there's a climate that there's a degree of tax evasion going on, and that's definitely not the case. If you look at what, say, Eric Schmidt said of Google yesterday, the chief executive chairman, the multinationals play by the rules, the governments make the rules, and what is necessary is this isn't an evasion game. This is much more than that. It's about ensuring that multinationals can give the best possible return to their shareholders. What's really got to come after this is the debate, which is going to happen probably in Moscow next month, about base erosion and profit shifting, which is far more relevant to Ireland, because we're not seen as, and we're definitely not a place where tax evasion occurs.
No, we're seen as a tax haven.
We're not a tax haven. Where
profits are located for advantageous purposes, but not taxed.
I think it's wrong to call us a tax haven. I think we're far removed from a tax haven. A tax haven is one of those countries like Cayman, Guernsey, Isle of Man, or you could even say some places like Luxembourg or Switzerland. But Ireland is not a tax haven. We're fully OECD compliant. We have a very clear come to Ireland, pay 12.5%, and develop your base here. Put your employees here. Put your capital
anyway,
here.
In a way, it doesn't matter what we are. If we're seen as a tax haven, if we're seen as a problem, then we are obviously, to a degree, in the firing line. What do you think Ireland should be doing? What stance should we be taking, apart from saying we're not a tax haven?
I think there's a great opportunity here for Minister Noonan to lead the debate and put Ireland in a position whereby we are the most attractive country in Europe, if not Europe, Middle East and Africa, for US multinational to come, to turn the debate so that, say, a US company wants to come here, it wants to be clear that the amount of tax it will pay in Ireland, the amount of tax it will pay in Europe and other European countries won't take their shares. So, for example, the whole base erosion and profit shifting debate is all about, linked to, say, Prime Minister Cameron, France getting a bigger share of the take of big corporations which are in Ireland. That's not fair. What's fair is if they've got their substance here, if they've got their employees here, Ireland should get the tax take. And we should make sure that that comes to Ireland, not go to other countries.
Yeah, but life's not fair. If there is a drift, and if it were to reach the point where companies were taxed on where their sales and profits occur, rather than where they're registered, that would be a worrying time for Ireland. Is there anything we can do about that? Do you think we should go along, the government should go along with what is clearly an international trend towards more reporting, more transparency, more clarity about beneficial ownership, where profits arise, where companies are based?
I think it should definitely steer clear of going down the sales route. I mean, it's quite clear what Europe has for sales tax is VAT. We've got a tax to deal with that. That's an end-user tax on people who buy the eventual product. We don't need to go down the sales tax. The key is to look who's got the employees, who's got the capital, who's got the real base. Some countries are better at some certain industries than the other. For example, the UK has a very strong financial services base. It has a very strong car industry. So that's fine. leave the car industry there, tax the car industry in the UK, not in Ireland necessarily, but then shift it.
All right, but it's
and
not,
look,
it's,
play to our strengths, play to our technology strengths.
Okay, the question is how. Okay, John Gulliver of Mason Hayes and Curran, thank you very much for talking to us. 7:27.
The conflict in Syria has overshadowed these G8 discussions. Last night, the leaders discussed the issue over a working dinner. Russia has been at odds with the rest of the group over its support for the Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad. Fawaz Gurgis is Professor of Middle Eastern Politics and International Relations at the London School of Economics, and he joins us on the line. What, if anything, do you expect to come from this gathering?
I don't expect a breakthrough to take place because the position between the position of Russia and the Western powers, basically there's a big divide between the two. Despite everything that has happened, neither the United States nor the European Union has been able to convince Russia to shift its position on Syria. Major differences, huge divide. I don't expect much to take place in the next day or so.
There is talk of a peace conference. What's being proposed?
Well, as you well know, the peace conference basically was agreed between the American Secretary of State, John Kerry, and his Russian counterpart. The Americans made a major concession. They accepted that the peace conference would take place without President Assad of Syria stepping down. Yet what has happened in the last few weeks is that the Assad regime basically has been on the offensive. It has achieved some major military gains. The opposition is on the defensive. It is losing territory and men. And what the Americans are trying to do is to really stem the tide of the Assad regime advance, because remember, you cannot have a peace conference where one particular camp is making advances and the other is retreating. So the Americans decided to arm the opposition in order to bring about some military balance on the battlefield and start the peace process. But neither the opposition nor the Assad regime is basically willing to come to the negotiating table and make the necessary concessions, and neither Russia nor the Western powers are willing to really press their allies in order to sit down and talk and make compromises.
As you say, the US has said that it's prepared to arm opposition forces, but what in effect does that mean? I mean, who's it prepared to arm, and what sort of weaponry are we talking about?
You know, Rachel, the Americans, Barack Obama, the American president, does not want to get engaged, embroiled in another military adventure in the Middle East. That's a reality. But the fact also, he has come under tremendous pressure from both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, and also America's regional allies, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, to intervene in Syria. The American decision is a very limited decision. The Americans are not trying to shift the balance of power in favor of the opposition. The Americans want to stem the tide of the advances of the Assad regime. They wanted to create a balance of terror on the ground, on the battlefield, so that basically both camps would sit down and talk. But the reality is, I don't think the American decision is a game changer. Remember, both Hezbollah, Iran, and Russia fully support the Assad regime, and the reality is we have to wait and see how and what the Americans would provide the opposition. Also remember, Rachel, the opposition is deeply divided. We're talking about the Free Syrian Army, which is basically a relatively secular, moderate force, but you have many militant elements inside Syria who are very potent, very skilled, and also they have made most of the fighting inside Syria. So the situation is very foggy, very difficult to read. The conference itself, the G8 conference, really will not produce any major breakthrough. At the end of the day, the Russians and the Americans have to sit down and basically decide on how to proceed. Otherwise, the fighting will continue. More Syrians will most likely be killed, unfortunately, in the next few days and next few months.
Professor Fawaz Gurgis, thank you very much for joining us with your analysis. It's 23 minutes to 8. Darren Frahill joins us with the sport. Darren, Joe Kinnear, he disappeared for a long time, but now that he's back in the news, he's back in the news in a big way.
Yeah, he's making up for last time, Rachel. And this morning, there's a lot of confusion over his future now at Newcastle United this morning, because he's claimed he signed a contract to become the new director of football there, but yet the club have yet to confirm his appointment. It really is a strange one. The former Newcastle manager, though, gave an extraordinary interview on UK radio last night. He claimed responsibility for signing Tim Krul, a goalkeeper recruited by Graeme Souness, as well as James Perch, a player signed by Chris Hughton. He also struggled to name some of the club's most prominent players. He called Yohan Cabaye, Yohan Kebab, and Hatem Ben Arfi. He claimed to be named Manager of the Year three times, when in reality he's won it once. He also boasted about his worldwide contacts that they were so extensive, no door was closed to him. When asked about the supporters' negativity towards him, he said he had more intelligence than them. Here's a flavour of what he had to say.
So, you know, and I look at my record, they keep saying to me, what did I do? I mean, where have these people been? Have they been on another planet? I've played in 5 cup finals and won the lot. I've had over 400 games for Tottenham Hotspur. I've been manager of the year 3 times. I've travelled the world as a manager. You know, this job come up, which I thought was a fairly responsible job, it's got nothing to do. Already they're jumping on the bandwagon. Watch out, Pardo, watch out this. But that's the snidey press. That's the people up there or around that area that I've upset, and they have a grudge. So I expect it, but it's water off a duck's ass.
That's a joke in here. We have a lot more, believe me, coming up from that radio interview a little later on. The British and Irish Lions play their final warm-up game ahead of their first test against Australia on Saturday. That match taking place this morning against the Brumbies in Canberra. His side, Warren Gatland's side today, features mostly fringe players. Rory Best, Sean O'Brien and Rob Kearney, though, do start. Conor Murray and Simon Zebo have been named on the bench. Michael Corcoran looks ahead to the action.
Wallaby squad members Peter Kimlin and Scott Seo are in the Brumby starting lineup for tonight's game against the British and Irish Lions at Canberra Stadium, where temperatures are expected to average around -3 degrees throughout the course of the game. Warren Gatland's side include 4 new players in the backline, including Shane Williams, along with Brad Barrett, Billy Twelvetrees and Christian Wade. Rory Best becomes the 3rd Irishman to captain the tour, and he certainly won't want to lead a losing side. Most of tonight's Brumby side played in the bonus point Super 15 win over Melbourne Rebels recently and have trained together since. Ian Pryor and Matumua will try to control the game at scrum half and out half, and if they can get quality ball to Clyde Rathbone and Henry Speight on the wings, they can cause the Lions some difficulty. Add in the threat of fullback Jesse Mogg, and the Brumbies will provide a stern test for the visiting side. 12 years ago, this game was decided by 1 score. Don't expect the latest encounter to be any different.
The Tyrone football manager Mickey Hart will have to plan without his goalkeeper Niall Morgan for the rest of the season. He picked up an injury in a club game at the weekend. Magician set to spearhead Aidan O'Brien's bid for a 7th St James's Palace Stakes success at Royal Ascot this afternoon. The Irish 2000 Guineas hero suffered a knock last week, but he will be fit. It's the one of 3 Group 1 races worth almost £200,000 each on today's card there. And finally, today's racing gets underway in Sligo at 5:45, beg your pardon.
America's first family put in an unexpected visit to a Dublin restaurant last night, where they dined on Carlingford oysters, Wicklow lamb, shepherd's pie and fish and chips. But their appearance in Matt the Thrasher's in Pembroke Street wasn't the only chance that the public got to rub shoulders with the Obamas yesterday. They'd made 2 earlier appearances in the capital. Their first at Trinity College, where our reporter Samantha Libreri was among the crowd.
You know, Michelle Obama is like the first lady of America, and she's like a good role model, so we thought we got to go in to see her.
No, I didn't know until we got here. Sure, I'm here now, so I'll stick around for a while and see.
Well, I was outside when John F. Kennedy came here. Oh yeah, I'd love to see her.
Tell me, how old are you and what's your name?
Isolt, and I'm 7 years old.
And why are you excited about seeing Michelle Obama?
Because she's the because her husband's the president.
And what do you like about her and her daughters?
Because they're pretty and they're famous.
There was delight when the Obamas arrived at the university, and as they spent an hour inside learning about their lineage, some lingered to try and catch another glimpse. But for most, it ended in disappointment.
I was straining to see as she went in, but I'm actually very disappointed.
Had you waited here long?
About an hour, yeah.
And what did you see?
Not too much, just hand waving through a dark window, yeah, that was it.
Did you get to see Michelle?
No.
No.
Not at all.
Had you been waiting long?
No, we were waiting an hour.
An hour, yeah.
Were you disappointed?
Very disappointed.
What did you see?
Just the top of her head, that's all.
Oh, well.
You glad you came anyway?
Of course I am.
Yeah, it's a great sense of occasion here, you know.
But a select few got FaceTime with the first family.
Patrick Prendergast, the Provost of Trinity College Dublin. I had the pleasure of introducing the Obama girls to my two daughters. They swapped some stories about being in New York and what to do when you're in New York. So that was good.
My name is Anne-Marie Diffley. I'm the Visitor Services Manager in the Old Library Building. It was a wonderful, happy, warm visit. This isn't our first big visit, but that doesn't mean to say there wasn't a little bit of nerves and a little bit of hope it goes okay, but it did, of course.
The Gaiety Theatre was the first family's second stop of the day. Among the invited guests, their distant cousin Henry Healy and Moneygall publican Ollie Hayes.
It's phenomenal, I suppose, that they continue to include us in everything that they do.
Was there a disappointment that they didn't go to Moneygall?
No one seems to be too disappointed, and the First Lady herself this morning told us that they do intend to return again to Ireland, and Moneygall has to be visited yet by Sasha Malia. So it doesn't matter, they can come at any time. Moneygall is always going to be there, but you know, it's fabulous that they've honoured their promise and came back to Ireland.
That's unbelievable to be invited here again today, and I was born like a child myself, my first time in the Gaiety, my first time seeing Riverdance, so bring it on.
And it was the children she mainly spoke to when Michelle Obama took to the stage before Riverdance.
I want you all to think really big about who you want to be. I want your imaginations to soar high. I want you to look at me and Barack and all these wonderful leaders and understand that we are you, just kids who worked a little hard and dreamt pretty big and got to do some wonderful things.
30 Moneygall school children got the biggest surprise of the day when they were taken backstage to meet Mrs. Obama face to face.
She said to finish up strong in school and she'd hope to be back for a visit soon.
And what was she like?
She was really tall and really kind.
She was just telling us that there's a lot of work being the First Lady and she has to be going around everywhere. She's doing a lot of stuff. She's very busy.
She treated us like we were famous and stuff instead of her. I was like, you're Michelle Obama. She was just like, it's really nice to meet you guys. It's so funny.
She's really tall and really kind. Samantha Librari reporting there. The Obamas off to Glendalough today, where it looks as though they'll have a fine day for it. 7:45, and we'll be returning to the G8 in just a moment.
It's 7:13, and back here at our Morning Ireland OB in Enniskillen, I'm joined by Justin Kilcullen, Executive Director of the Irish Aid Agency, Trochra. The G8 leaders out the road, they're continuing their discussions on trade, taxation, transparency and so forth, and indeed Syria. But from your own perspective, do these events, I mean, just going back, you've been observing them for many years, is there any good news to report about the ultimate effect of what they do?
Well, certainly the G8 summit in Cologne in the year 2000 was a great success in terms of the debt issue. You might remember that all thousands of people came and surrounded Cologne. We held hands and encircled the city. And that really did have an impact. And there was major change on the third world debt issue after that. The Gleneagles one in 2005, Make Poverty History, was a success. Unfortunately, what was pledged wasn't delivered as it had been so promised because of the recession. But it did move the game forward. And each of these events, I think, means there's a bit of progress made.
The stakes would seem to be particularly high here for third world countries, because it seems to be very much now in the interests of the developed countries to do something about multinationals and the tax they pay or maybe don't pay.
Well, this is a real opportunity today for the developing world because, as you say, we have seen in the Western countries now how multinational corporations have been able to rob our revenues from us by moving the money around the country and not paying taxes. The UK in particular has been very badly affected by this, by Amazon, by Google and others, and that's been very high profile. And the people in the UK are raging about it, and quite rightly so. The people in the developing world have been saying this for the last 20 years, that multinational corporations come out, they do sweetheart deals with corrupt officials, money is sent off to Switzerland, to the Caribbean and what have you, and the resources of many African countries, which are essentially wealthy countries, you know, occupied by poor people, are just being stolen from under their noses. And this will stop it if we can get this taxation and this transparency, the two T's they're talking about, in place today.
I've seen a figure of $123 billion annually as the loss to the developing world, to those countries alone. Now, one measure that some experts are suggesting needs to be applied as to whether they will assist on transparency from companies to those third world countries from the multinationals.
Absolutely. Everything has to be done openly and accountably. So, what the developing countries are losing three times as much in unpaid tax as they're getting in development aid. The net winners all the time are the Western economies, and we want to reverse that. And if it is made clear that deals have to be done openly, they have to be accountable to Parliament, there has to be a register of interests, publish what you pay is one of the slogans we've been using for years, so that the capacity of developing countries to build their revenue base, so they have their own taxation, their own revenue to develop their own countries. I mean, people say aid doesn't work and we're giving too much aid and they become dependent on us. I think this shows up the lie of that. These countries are only dependent on aid because the money they're entitled to is being taken away from them. That's what we have to reverse.
We'll see how it goes. Justin Kilcullen, Executive Director of Throcker, thanks for being with us. It's just after 10 to 8. Time for business news. Here's Conor Brophy.
Thanks, Sean. Newry-based First Derivatives, which sells software and provides consulting to the financial services industry, has reported a 22.5% rise in revenue to £56.5 million over the past 12 months. On that, it made a full-year pre-tax profit of £11.5 million, up 7% year-on-year. Among its products, First Derivatives sells software which helps exchanges monitor suspicious trades and potential insider dealing. It counts among its customers the Australian stock market regulator ASIC. Now, speaking of regulators, the last time he opened his mouth at a press conference in May, Ben Bernanke, the chairman of America's central bank, the Federal Reserve, sparked a sell-off that's wiped about $2.5 trillion off the value of global markets. Today, the Fed begins another two-day meeting of its Open Markets Committee, and investors naturally are nervous about what Mr. Bernanke might say afterwards. Well, to look ahead at what's going to go on at the FOMC, we can speak now to Brenda Kelly, analyst with IG Group in London. Brenda, Ben Bernanke's in a difficult spot here because obviously the reason for that sell-off was that he's been trying to lay out some sort of roadmap about when the US or Federal Reserve might start pulling back on this huge stimulus it's been providing to help kind of get the US economy into gear.
Absolutely, and I suppose in a way he's trying to temper any expectations for the last number of weeks since the 22nd of May when he first rolled out sort of markers that we would see some tapering at some stage in the game sooner rather than later. That was when we started to see the topping in the market and the recent sell-off that we've seen so far. So the two-day policy meeting, we're expecting to see that tapering will actually occur, but it's mostly about the actual interest rate that should be of interest. The first rate hike by the Fed is actually slated for late 2014. Or early 2015. So even a mild amount of tapering won't necessarily have such a downward effect on the markets. It's just the uncertainty that is driving the markets lower at the moment.
Now, I said a $2.5 trillion sell-off. I suppose you have to put that in the context of the huge run-up we'd seen in global stock markets since pretty much the back end of last year.
Precisely. If you've even counted since March 2009, we've seen the S&P 500 rally by about 140%. So any sort of downward correction by even as much as 15% is not exactly what we call a reversal and is only really kind of healthy and allows other investors to get in at a better level. So I think even in the year-to-date sort of scenario, I think the correction we've seen so far is very much keeps the uptrend intact and doesn't necessarily offset a lot of the rally that we've seen so far.
The trick here, I suppose, and what Ben Bernanke has tried to indicate that he's going to do is once the economic data and once the underlying economy is at a healthy enough point, then they take away the drip. But what signs have we been seeing in recent weeks from the US about how healthy or otherwise the underlying economy actually is?
Well, we've seen some mixed data so far, but I think unemployment seems to be coming on the good front. But I think it's mostly the housing figures that are the real the winner, I suppose, the bellwether of everything so far. We've seen home builders reporting a surge in business in June, and that pushed the number above levels that hadn't been seen since the onset of the housing crisis 7 years ago. And that yesterday was what was pushed the markets higher. So it was actually based on good fundamentals rather than bad fundamentals, which meant that we'd see further quantitative easing. But all in all, retail sales have been better. I think the US has pretty much recouped a lot of the economic success that we haven't really seen here in Europe. And I think in some respects, they will be the first central bank to tighten. And it's something we're going to have to get used to. But I think by the time it happens, it will be well and truly discounted into the market.
The big headline from an economic front at the G8, Brenda, was this talk of the EU-US trade deal and the steps that might take place to get that underway. It's been called a non-cash stimulus package on both sides of the Atlantic. Does that move the needle much in terms of what investors are looking at? Do people respond to that in a positive fashion?
Well, I'm sure it would be positive in the longer term. I don't think on an intraday basis we're going to see any big moves in the market, either in the FX area or the equity area. But certainly the idea of a trade talk or a trade deal, which could probably reach within a couple of years, is probably going to be a good thing. But nonetheless, I don't expect to see any market moves today on the back of it.
Now, you touched on foreign exchange there, and I know it's a touchy subject to bring up with an Irish expat living in London, but sterling very much moving in the wrong direction as far as we're concerned here at the moment.
Absolutely. We are anchored around the 85 pence mark at the moment. And obviously, if your debts are in euro and you're earning in sterling, that's not such a good thing. But nonetheless, inflation numbers over in the UK are exceptionally high, even comparison to the likes of the rest of the eurozone. So we're expecting today to see inflation numbers for May from the UK. And we're expecting to see an annualised rise from 2.4% in April to 2.6% in May, which is well above the 2% target. So I think in some ways that could underpin sterling and give it a little bit more strength in the lead up to the Bank of England minutes tomorrow.
Brenda Kelly, analyst with IG Group in London, thanks very much for talking us through that. Just the other currency news there, the euro, as Brenda mentioned, at around 85 pence sterling, and this morning at $1.33.5.
Hello, good morning from Matt Aaron. Any early morning fog will clear soon, and today will be a warm day with spells of sunshine, but some areas will stay rather cloudy, especially the west, with perhaps some light rain or drizzle on Atlantic coasts. High temperatures generally between 18 and 22 degrees, but it will stay a bit cooler in western coastal areas. Winds will be mostly light and westerly, and in the afternoon, light onshore breezes will develop on east and southeast coasts. Tonight will be mainly dry with clear spells and lowest temperatures of 9 to 12 degrees in little or no wind. Tomorrow will be another warm day in many areas, with a mix of cloudy periods and sunny intervals. It will stay mainly dry, but some rain will develop near west coast towards evening. High temperatures tomorrow of 16 to 21 degrees, highest in the east and south, and coolest on Atlantic coast. Thursday will be fairly warm as well. Some rain might develop later in the west, and possibly in the southeast as well, but most areas will continue dry. It looks like Friday will be a wet day everywhere, with rain and drizzle on west coast spreading to all places during the day, but it will stay rather mild in mainly moderate southwest breezes. Saturday is likely to be a breezy and showery day, and it will turn cooler. Some showers could be heavy and prolonged, but there will be bright and dry intervals also. Sunday is looking quite cool and breezy as well, with winds becoming more northerly. Weather-wise, there will be a mix of sunshine and showers. But back to today, becoming warm in many areas with sunny intervals, and it will stay mainly dry in light winds. And that's all for me. A very good morning.